upgrade your tool storage for the new year with help from Menards. For heavy-duty storage that protects your tools, choose MasterForce. From shelving units to cabinets and so much more, you can keep your tools safe and within reach. Get versatile and durable storage from MasterForce today. Check out all our MasterForce storage in-store or check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money
at Menards. If you are currently wading through the sheer volume of rules governing commercial landscape maintenance in California, especially, you know, the pesticide regulations, it can feel less like studying and more like trying to decipher an ancient, complicated manuscript.
Oh, absolutely. It's intense.
It's so dense, and the stakes for compliance and for passing your exams are exceptionally high.
That's exactly the challenge. And for those of you who are pursuing certification, this deep dive is specifically tailored to the knowledge required for the Qualified Applicator License, the QEL Category B exam.
Right.
Understanding the regulatory architecture isn't just about memorizing statutes. It's about internalizing the system to ensure safe legal operation.
And that's our mission today. We are taking a deep dive into the absolute core California pesticide laws and the precise licensing and reporting requirements that landscape maintenance professionals must master. Okay, let's unpack this.
We're pulling the essential nuggets from the foundational study materials, structuring this discussion as really the ultimate tool for you to cement your understanding of the QAL and QAC requirements. We also want to mention this is part of a series generated by Within Range Coaching.
A fantastic resource.
It is. Their whole mission is cultivating a broader and better agriculture industry through education, safety, and most importantly, compliance.
Before we get into the certificates and all that, let's start with the why. Why does California regulate pesticide use with such a heavy hand?
It really boils down to multiple layers of protection. I mean, it's outlined pretty clearly in the source material. It's about protecting the handlers, applying the material, the workers nearby, and of course, the general public.
Especially in high density areas.
Exactly. And it's also about protecting the natural environment, ensuring proper product labeling, and critically, making sure that pest control is handled only by competent and licensed professionals.
Okay, so the regulatory power structure, it all begins at the federal level, right?
Correct. The foundational law for the entire nation is the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act, or FIFR, as we all call it.
FIFR, right.
It's been around since 1947, modernized most notably by the 1992 Worker Protection Standard, and the U.S. EPA sets those national standards. These are the minimum standards.
But wait, here's the crucial insight that I think trips up so many people studying for this exam. California is not bound by the minimum.
That's the key legal precedent. The California Department of Pesticide Regulation, the DPR, assumes the state role. And unlike federal law, which dictates the floor, California is legally empowered to establish laws and regulations that are more restrictive than the federal standard.
That's why California feels so unique. Can you give us a quick example of that enhanced restriction?
The best example probably relates to reporting. Federally, reporting might be required primarily for, you know, restricted use pesticides. But here in California, the law requires reporting of all pesticide use applied in commercial settings.
All of it.
All of it. Including every application made by landscape maintenance professionals. This is a massive administrative difference that starts on day one of operation.
And when you look at the sheer number of agencies involved, it's understandable why the state is so restrictive. Federally, you have what, the EPA, USDA, NIOSH?
Right, a few key players.
Yeah.
But the list of state agencies you could potentially interact with is, well, it's staggering.
It's a huge list.
It is a crowded regulatory field. You've got the Department of Health Services, the Air Resources Board, Fish and Game, Cal/OSHA enforcing worker safety, the various water resources control boards, and the Structural Pest Control Board. It's a lot of cooks in the kitchen.
All tasked with protecting some element of public health or the environment.
Exactly.
Amidst all those state agencies, the one body you, the applicator, will interact with most directly is your local county agricultural commissioner, the CATI.
Right.
What exactly is their operational role?
The CAC is basically the arm of the DPR on the ground. They're vital because they aren't just rubber stamping state rules. They have the authority to develop specific county policies or conditions unique to that county's local environmental or public health needs.
Can you give us a hypothetical of what a CAC might require that the state law doesn't explicitly mandate?
Certainly.
Mm-hmm.
So state law might set a general buffer zone for certain applications near, say, dwellings. But a specific CAC might notice repeated complaints near a sensitive habitat, like a specific bird nesting area, or near a cluster of organic farms.
Okay.
They can then draft a county policy requiring a greater buffer distance or prohibiting application during certain high-risk months.
So their policies tailor the statewide restrictions to the local ecosystem, and those policies are enforceable. But they can't just make up rules on the fly, can they?
No, and that's a crucial check on their power. Before any county-specific policy or condition becomes operative, it must first be approved by the director of the DPR.
So there's oversight.
Always. This ensures consistency and legality across the state, even while allowing for that local variation.
That distinction brings us to a foundational point of confusion for many. The legal hierarchy itself. We've mentioned laws and regulations. What's the definitive difference for an applicator?
That is a great question. Think of the legal hierarchy like a government building. The laws, which are passed by the California legislature and are part of the California Food and Agricultural Code, they are the foundation and the structure. They state the broad intent.
So something like pesticides must be used safely.
Exactly. That's the law.
And the regulations.
The regulations, which are set by the DPR and found in Title III of the California Code of Regulations, they're the detailed operating manual that makes the building function. They interpret and carry out the laws. The regulation says, to use pesticides safely, you must wear this specific type of respirator under these conditions.
Ah, so they provide the practical, enforceable working rules.
You got it. That's the difference.
That makes the distinction instantly clear. Okay, let's jump to the heart of the matter for our listeners. Certification. When do I need a Qualified Applicator Certificate, or QAC, or the Higher Qualified Applicator License, QAO?
Well, the need generally kicks in if you use or supervise the use of federally restricted use pesticides or state restricted materials. This applies regardless of whether you are treating a huge farm or a small residential yard.
Unless you fall under that narrow private applicator definition.
Right, which usually only applies to agricultural producers on their own land. For landscape pros, it's QAC or QAL.
And the distinction between the two. The difference between a QAC and a QAL is critical for people planning their career path.
It absolutely is. The QAC is the Certificate of Competence. It qualifies you to use or supervise the use of restricted materials. But if you are aiming to start your own business, hire employees, and be the designated head supervisor for a licensed company,
and you need the QAL,
then the QAL is the license you must target.
Why the jump? What makes it different?
Because the QAL specifically indicates that the person is qualified to supervise the entire operation of a licensed pest control business. The QAC gets you on the restricted materials list. The QAL allows you to run the show commercially.
Let's focus on the two main QAL categories for landscape work, starting with the broadest. The landscape maintenance pest control category. What's the scope here?
This category is for companies that offer full-service pest control for hire. It allows you to use or supervise the use of general use and restricted materials across a wide variety of sites.
Like what?
Residential yards, commercial turf areas, interior scapes, schoolyards, recreation areas, and landscaped street medians. Pretty much the works.
And crucially, if a business performs pest control for hire under this scope, what must they have?
They need two things: a pest control business license from the DPR, and they must have a QEL holder in this category on staff to supervise.
Now, here's a point to remember. The business license requirement applies even if the company only uses general use pesticides, right?
That's right. If you are applying for compensation for hire, you need the business license, period.
Then you have the smaller scope, the maintenance gardener pest control category. What's the difference here?
This license is highly constrained. It limits the gardener to performing only incidental pest control for hire and strictly within landscape and turf plantings.
So think private residences.
Exactly. Private residences or just the plantings immediately surrounding a commercial structure. This category is really designed for those whose primary business is gardening, with pest control as a secondary, occasional activity.
And the licensing for the maintenance gardener is slightly different as well.
That's right. To operate in this limited capacity, the individual must hold a QAC or QAL in the maintenance gardener category or the broader landscape maintenance category, and the business must hold a maintenance gardener pest control business license.
So we've established that any commercial operation needs a pest control business license, or PCBL. What are the four key administrative steps required to secure that PCBL? This is prime exam material.
It is, so pay close attention. One, the business supervisor must hold a valid QAL or QAC in the appropriate category. Two, financial responsibility. You have to show proof of insurance, typically via a certificate of insurance or an accord form that meets the state's requirements.
Okay, so that covers the people and the liability.
Right.
What about the paperwork proving the business is legitimate?
That's number three, business verification. This means providing an official document proving your existence, like a fictitious business name statement if you're a sole proprietor, or a certificate of good standing if you are a corporation.
And the fourth.
And four, which applies if you hire anyone, proof of workers' compensation insurance. If you are an employer, this is mandatory. No way around it.
Once they have that license in hand, are they ready to work anywhere in California?
Not quite. That PCBL is a statewide license, but the business must still be registered with the CACI in each county where it intends to perform work.
And that's an annual thing, right?
An annual requirement, yes. It underscores the hyper-local control the CAC wields.
Are there any common sense exceptions to needing the PCBL for applications?
Yes. The main exception relates to new construction. No PCBL is required for pest control that is truly incidental to new construction activities. So this covers things like preparing a site for paving, establishing new landscape, that kind of thing.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because we shift from getting the license to staying compliant every single day. Let's start with the one document that is always paramount, the pesticide label.
The label is not a suggestion. It is the law. It's the legal mandate for safe handling, proper storage, and disposal. Legally, the complete label or a legible copy must be at the application site for every product being used.
We often hear about the four times you must read the label. Is there one of those four times that applicators most frequently forget, leading to compliance issues?
I think so. People forget the reading when storing pesticides for the long term or right before disposal. Everyone tends to read it before buying and before mixing, but compliance failures often happen during those administrative steps.
So, to recap, before buying, before mixing, applying, when storing, and before disposing.
That's it. All four are legally required.
Now, this is the aha moment for many people studying. The label is the law, but California regulations offer you, the certified applicator, a powerful trust allowance. Six ways you can legally deviate from that label.
That's the key. They are rooted in safety and responsibility. These deviations generally make the application safer or less disruptive. But always, and I mean always, check with DPR or your CAC if you are unsure.
Which two deviations are most important for landscape professionals to remember?
The two most critical relate to rate and frequency. One, you are legally allowed to use a lower application rate than the label recommends.
Then why would you do that?
Well, often it's done to protect beneficial insects or to use insensitive environments. But the flip side is non-negotiable. You can never legally increase the application rate beyond the maximum label rates.
That is a hard limit.
It is. The second deviation is frequency. You can apply a pesticide less frequently than specified on the label, provided your monitoring confirms that the application is still providing adequate control.
And what about the other allowed deviations?
They include controlling an unnamed pest if the site is listed on the label, using any method of application that's not specifically prohibited, mixing the pesticide with other registered pesticides or fertilizers, unless mixing is prohibited, and decreasing the concentration of the mixture.
Compliance means communicating. When you are performing pest control for hire, you have to notify the property owner or operator before the application begins. What's the minimum info that notice has to include?
The requirements are specific and must be met prior to the application, especially since others have access to the area. You must provide the date of the scheduled application, the brand name or common chemical name of the pesticide, and the specific precautions people need to observe.
Like re-entry times.
Exactly. Like waiting 24 hours before re-entry or keeping pets off the lawn.
Moving from notification to the paper trail. Record keeping. This is where administrative compliance can fail if you aren't disciplined. How long must commercial records be maintained?
Detailed pesticide use records must be maintained for a period of 2 years if you are applying pesticides for hire or if you are using any restricted use or agricultural use pesticide.
And what's the bare minimum content for those records?
Okay, you need the date, the name and location of the operator or property treated, the specific site treated, total units treated, the name of the pesticide, including its EPA or state registration number, and the total amount of product used.
Let's tackle the operator identification number, or OIN. This is a notorious source of confusion for new businesses. Do I need one if I have a PCBL?
This is a great point to clarify. Generally, OINs are for property operators in commercial agricultural production. However, if you perform pest control for hire, meaning you are a contractor or an employee of a business applying for others, you are generally exempt from obtaining that OIN yourself.
So if I'm a licensed company, I don't need the OIN, but I still have to report the use.
Exactly. Exempt from the OIN requirement, but absolutely not exempt from reporting. Monthly summary pesticide use reports are mandatory if you apply pesticides for hire.
And that report has to be delivered to the County Agricultural Commissioner by the 10th day of the month following the month of application.
That deadline, the 10th, is a compliance trip hazard many run into. You can't be late.
And if you work at K-12 school sites, there is another layer of annual reporting, correct?
That's right. If you apply pesticides for hire at a K-12 school site, you have to submit an additional yearly pesticide use report. It's a specific DPR form, PRENF-117, and that has to be filed by January 30th of the succeeding year.
Now let's talk about the products that demand the highest scrutiny. Restricted materials. We've mentioned them, but what formally defines them in the eyes of the law?
These are materials expected to cause what the law calls an unreasonable adverse effect on people or the environment, even when used according to the label.
That's a strong definition.
The criteria are harsh. Danger to public health, specific hazards to workers or wildlife, or the risk of persistent residues in soil or water.
So if a certified applicator needs to use one of these materials, the compliance process starts long before the spray rig even leaves the yard. What is the first prerequisite?
You need a restricted material permit from the HPICI to purchase, possess, or use these materials. And crucially, the permit holder must also be a certified applicator, a QAC or QAL holder.
And the final hurdle before application, the one that often results in violations because of the timing requirement.
The big one. If you are planning to use a restricted material, you can't just walk out the door. You have to give the KIKI a formal heads up called a Notice of Intent, or NOI, at least 24 hours prior to the intended application.
And that allows the KIKI to monitor the application if they need to.
Exactly. They can verify conditions are met. Huh. Missing that 24-hour window is a very, very common administrative violation.
This raises an important question. What happens if you skip these steps? If you forget to file that NOI or fail to maintain the required 2 years of records, what is the weight of the enforcement action?
The DPR and the CCAG have significant escalating power. They can start with compliance actions like a warning letter or maybe an interview, but they can quickly escalate to enforcement actions, which involve serious financial penalties.
And those fines are substantial.
They start high. Administrative penalties handed down by the DPR can result in fines up to $5,000 per violation. For instance, every single time you fail to maintain a record for a specific application, that could be a separate violation.
And if it goes beyond the administrative process?
If it escalates to civil court action, the fines can go up to $25,000 per violation. And the most severe cases can trigger criminal court action by the district attorney.
Which means?
Fines from $500 to $50,000 per violation and imprisonment for up to 1 year. Compliance is not optional. It is a serious legal responsibility.
Given that the regulatory landscape is constantly shifting, maintaining compliance naturally leads us to the requirement for continuing education, or CE. Why is this renewal process mandatory?
Because the world doesn't stand still. I mean, lawmakers change rules, new pesticide chemicals are developed, new pests and resistance issues are constantly emerging. CE ensures that certified applicators stay current.
It makes you a more effective and safer steward of the environment.
It does.
Let's nail down the hour requirements for our listeners. What does a standard QAL or QAC in the landscape maintenance category need to renew every 2 years?
They need 20 hours of continuing education every 2 years, and at least 4 of those hours must specifically cover pesticide use laws and regulations.
And the requirements for the more constrained maintenance gardener subcategory?
Due to limited scope of work, that requirement is lower. 8 hours every 2 years, with a minimum of 2 hours focused on laws and regulations.
This was a rapid journey through the complexity of California regulation. To summarize our key takeaways, remember that the QAL is the ultimate target if you want to run a business, and that any business applying pesticides for hire needs a PCBL.
Regardless of whether they use general use or restricted materials.
Yeah, exactly.
And internalize the fact that the label is the law, but California allows those 6 specific deviations that trust your judgment to prioritize safety most critically. Always use a lower rate than the maximum, never a higher rate.
And finally, your administrative life depends on strict record keeping for 2 years and submitting those monthly pesticide use reports to the CAP by the 10th day of the following month.
I want to leave you with one final thought that bridges the technical material we discussed today with your professional judgment. We defined restricted materials as those causing unreasonable adverse effects.
Great.
The definition of unreasonable effects on the environment under FIFRA is fascinating because it is inherently subjective. It requires balancing the economic, social, and environmental costs and benefits of the pesticide use.
That sounds like a constant ethical tightrope walk.
It is. It's not simply about raw toxicity. It's a complex balancing act where you have to consider the benefit of keeping a park safe for children versus the potential environmental risk of the product. As a certified applicator, that balance weighing cost, social need, and environmental impact is the ultimate critical thinking challenge every time you pick up a product.
Excellent point. Thank you for guiding us through this essential material on the deep dive. We'll see you next time.